Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, liberty-loving patriots. Welcome to the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann Show. Please be sure to tune in Sunday nights from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, to discuss current events, news, and political opinion with Lucid Libertarian flair. Be prepared, folks. We often go into an optional extended third hour. This show advocates for liberty, freedom, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and limited government, while speaking against corporate and government corruption, tyranny, and the globalist Great Reset agenda that undermines our precious American sovereignty. Discussions here are unscripted and free-flowing, so sometimes conversations wander off in unpredictable directions. Would you like to call in and share your thoughts and be part of the conversation? The number is 563-999-3698. Again, that is 563-999-3698. Then press number 1 and you'll be added to the queue. Please also like and follow my Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann page on Facebook. You can help me battle their freedom-loathing censorship by visiting my page regularly, along with reacting, commenting, and sharing my posts. Thank you so much for listening, but please sit tight and don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a few minutes to kick off the show.
Imagine waking up in a trunk. What is grooming? What if I told you we had a 40% increase of human and sex trafficking in our country due to COVID lockdowns? We already had high numbers to begin with. One's Purpose is an amazing organization pounding the pavement every day, helping these survivors get help. Unfortunately, they do not have the funding they need for a safe house. In the state of Oregon, we have zero safe houses for these survivors who have endured the most heinous of crimes. The time is now to get involved. The time is now to help stop human trafficking. Please go to onespurpose.com to get involved. If you need help and if you know someone who needs to get help, please contact 541-221-3448. Make a donation. Make a difference.
Open your eyes and see.
Well, hello, everybody, all you liberty and freedom-loving people out there. You are tuned in to the Lucid Libertarian with Lori Ann Show special. As I've been doing on Wednesday nights, I like to throw in a special episode where I can play like a longer documentary or clip that I don't normally have the time to play on the regular Sunday show. And so last week on Wednesday, I played part one of The Viral Delusion, The Deadly Deception. Very, very informative. It was like 2 hours and 20 minutes long, though. So that was the longest of them. So tonight, I'm going to be playing part two. Part two is about 1 hour, 6 minutes long. So there should be plenty of time after it gets done playing for y'all to call in and have a conversation, talk about the latest and greatest news going on, talk about this clip. It is very informative. Like I said, I kind of just stumbled upon it. I don't even know like exactly how I stumbled upon the series, but this, you know, part two of five parts to this, The Viral Delusion, The Deadly Deception. And I encourage you to watch the videos as well, of course, because, you know, you're missing the visuals that go along with audio. Audio is very informative. And I just happened upon it. I think I was, you know, watching something else and then just stumbled upon this five-part series and was like, ooh, this would be a good one to spend some time playing on my Wednesday special shows. So here we are. All of these, Viral Delusion, The Deadly Deception, they are available on Rumble. And so if you go to Rumble, you should be able to find them, The Viral Delusion. And the person that posted it is Jose Ortega, The World We Live In. So you can subscribe and, you know, search for the videos there if you want to watch them. I know I like to listen to the audio while it's playing, and then I just sort of sync it up and play it at the same time in another tab so I can watch it as well as listen to it. And so if you guys are out there and you want to do that, if you're looking at the link for tonight's show, I have it linked there as well. So you can go directly to The Viral Delusion, The Deadly Deception, Part 2 of 5. And then I also linked in there as well the Part 1 in case you missed the show last week or you want to go and do that. And then I am actually remembering to open up the chat. Better late than never, right? So bad at remembering to open up the chat. So I want to get ready to cue this puppy up. If you want to, go ahead and call in at 563-999-3698. Again, that is 563-999-3698. And then kick back, relax. We'll listen to this and then when you want to talk, just press 1. That raises your hand and lets me know that you want to talk instead of just sitting back and listening. So I'm going to get ready to cue up The Viral Delusion Part 2. And I'm getting my other tab open here to be ready to push play on it so I can sync it up here. And so 1 hour, 6 minutes of this part two, and I'm going to kick it off now here. 3, 2, 1, and launch.
So when this whole thing got started, we're talking now late 1800s, basically Pasteur and Koch and a few other people said, every disease has to be correlated with one microorganism. And at the time, before electron microscopes, they could only see, they only had a light microscope, so they could see bacteria. So they found certain diseases like anthrax, where they found a bacteria. Now, interestingly, they didn't find it in everybody with anthrax, which is odd, because if anthrax was caused by a bacteria, you would think everybody would have it. Number two, they could find a lot of people who had the bacteria in their tissues who were totally fine. Anyways, so they had a bunch of illnesses which they could see a bacteria, and then they had illnesses, and in particular polio, where they couldn't find a bacteria, right? No bacteria, they know they're sick, they seem to be happening in communities, therefore it must be some pathogen smaller than a bacteria which we can't see. That's the thinking. So they called it a virus, meaning that's the old Latin word for poison. So there was some smaller than a bacteria, we can't see it, and that must be what's causing all these people to be sick in situations where we can't find a bacteria. So how do we prove it? Well, we take tissue from somebody with polio and we grind it up, and sometimes they would filter it, so they would take the supernatant, the liquid part, and then expose it to different animals. And they tried about 20 different animals. And then you find something very interesting. The trouble with determining that polio was a virus was they couldn't find an animal model. In other words, they couldn't find an animal that got sick from the virus. Now think about that for a minute. So they get stuff from somebody with polio. They try guinea pigs and hamsters and monkeys and rats and mice and gerbils and everything. None of them got sick. So some people would say, that means the thing doesn't make you sick. What they said was, there's no animal model for that virus. And so there was no tissue model. They hadn't discovered how to make vero cells sick yet. There's no tissue model, there's no animal model, so how do we know that it's making anybody sick? Well, because a bunch of people in the same place get sick, so that must mean it's a virus. So then they said, well, we can try one more time. So they took a child who had polio, they took some of their spinal tissue, ground it up in some water, filtered it, so that they got rid of the cellular stuff. So they have just basically ground up liquid diseased spinal cord, right? That's not a virus. That's a whole lot of things. And they got two monkeys, they drilled a hole in the monkey's brain, injected I don't know how much of this goop into the monkey's brain. One monkey died and the other got paralyzed. They hold the monkey up and say, see, we've transmitted the virus to the monkey. Now, as I said, the only thing I can say for sure is that if you're a monkey and somebody wants to inject diseased spinal cord directly into your brain, your best bet is to run. Because it's a good chance that nothing good will come out of it. And in fact, there's such a thing as called brainstem herniation, which means if you inject stuff into your brain, the brainstem herniates down and gets stuck in the bony, hole, and then you die. So you would think that if you're going to inject like a half a cup of diseased brain, spinal cord into somebody's brain, you would do a half a cup of saline or milk or something to see. Maybe it's because of the injection of stuff into a monkey's brain. But they didn't do that. They didn't do any controls. They just said that 1907 was the proof that polio is caused by a virus. And you read that and you think, what the heck? Like that's not, that's just nuts. Thank you.
experiments where they had essentially a child who died of polio, and they took like the brain and spinal cord, or just the spinal cord, that's where polio affects the disease. It's actually, the name of the disease is poliomyelitis, which is means that it is, affects a specific part of the spinal cord. And polio is just short for that. And so what they did is they took children who died of polio, and they took that their spinal cord that was diseased, and they chopped it up in a blender, and they tried to give it to experimental animals to see if they could cause polio. And they gave it to them every which way. Like they shoved it down their nose or throat, they even injected it, and none of the animals got polio. So finally what they did was they actually took this chopped up spinal cord and they opened up the brain of some monkeys and put it directly in the brain. Well, you know, if you put up dead, rotting tissue from an animal directly into the brain, you know it's going to cause some problems. And it did, and they basically said, based on that, here's your evidence that this thing causes polio.
So if you go to medical school, what you learn is they proved that polio was a virus. That's what you learn. Even you don't even really learn that, but you just learn that it's a virus. And you assume that somebody someday must have shown that it was a virus. And nobody says, okay, by the way, could you show me the original study that showed this? Nobody said that. Everybody knows it's a virus. You don't ask, you know, for evidence or proof. That is the proof. Once that becomes sort of the dogma, you can't say, I don't think this is a virus.
I'm an orthodox doctor, and I always thought polio is a classic infectious disease, which is limited now by vaccination. But when we further dig in that problem, we found out that there was no purification of this virus and no animal model of the poliovirus that causes disease in the animal. Instead, the assumption that polio is transmissible goes back to experiments from Landsteiner, but they did, like Gadusek, intracerebral inoculation. And that's really, for me, it's not a proof for a transmissible virus. That's, as we know now, it's an allergic reaction against foreign proteins when you inject foreign protein into the brain. Then you get acute allergic encephalitis.
Now, what they never looked at is that there was an invasive species brought over from Europe called the gypsy moth. And it was devastating because it was eating all the fruit trees when it came to the country. And they started using a compound called lead arsenate, which would kill this moth. But this was really the first time they used a chemical pesticide, and people didn't have experience or know what they were doing, and so they didn't take precautions, and they basically doused everything with this stuff. And they did this, of course, in the spring. And when did we see polio cases? Every summer. So what would happen is that this lead arsenate started getting sprayed on all the fruit crops to prevent the moth from devastating them. Then when they started harvesting the summer fruit, like the strawberries in June, et cetera, the kids who are more sensitive to neurotoxins because they're developing and they're small, they would eat this fruit, get the lead arsenate, and some of them would be paralyzed if they got enough. And this happened in the seasonal pattern that exactly matched when they would apply the lead arsenate.
These communities that got polio were the ones that were being sprayed with lead arsenic. We know that lead arsenic is a specific neurotoxin for the anterior horn cells of the nervous system, exactly the part that's affected with polio.
In Massachusetts, I think, where there was a town where they had installed a couple of cotton mills, and below the cotton mills, there was a polio epidemic. So what happened to the cotton industry at the time? they were introducing carbon tetrachloride in order to dissolve the cottonseed oil out of the cottonseed, which is a chemical like DDT, basically. This is like 1908. And then also, when they did the review of this epidemic, they stated that this epidemic does not have the characteristics of an epidemic. There's no, you can't really trace one person to another as if it was a germ epidemic.
And basically, this kept up, and at some point, they switched from lead arsenate to DDT.
Now, people started talking about polio itself, and the iron lung disease, and the permanent disease, and the paralysis. It had to have been a polio virus. They don't stop to look at the fact that DDT, which was sprayed in many areas in the West, when exposed to the body, causes paralysis.
DDT, for instance, is one of the most famous toxins, which was used in the 40s, 50s. When we didn't know that it's no toxin, we didn't know that at that time.
There are studies that show that DDT causes disintegration of the anterior horn, which is the definition of infantile paralysis, polio. And they did studies on animals. They also found that around 1951 that the calves of cattle that were grazing on DDT doused fields on grass that had DDT in it, that the calves were dying of neurological symptoms similar to polio. So that was one of the things that officially brought an end to DDT, was that the children of cattle were dying, but nobody cared about the children of humans.
Interestingly, in the veterinary medicine and in the animal medicine, polio, the paralyzed calves, were suggested to be caused by the high DDT levels in the cow milk.
When I was a kid, polio was a huge thing. I was raised right in the middle of the polio epidemic, and I remember one of the classmates in grade school. She was on crutches and she had polio, and so it was a big deal in my mind. And I also understood the timeline of DDT, but I never put them together. It's amazing we don't all put it together. You know, they poured tons of DDT all over the place, and there was no symptoms. You know. So it was pretty obvious.
You know, I remember, I don't know how old you guys are, I remember as a child in Detroit where they had the biggest outbreak of polio. In the summer, we used to run behind these machines that were spraying out this sweet-smelling gas, right? So that they would go to the ball fields, and this sprayer would come, and it would spray out, it smelled like bubble gum. And it would be, you'd run around, and sometimes you had your bicycle, and you'd ride around in the mist, in the bubblegum mist. You know what they were spraying? It was DDT. And that was exactly the place where I grew up, where they had the biggest outbreak of polio in history, was in Detroit. And DDT is a specific neurotoxin for the anterior horn cells of the nervous system. And every place where you see polio outbreaks has one of those two as, you know, something that happened, like they go to India and they spray DDT or some organophosphate insecticide. Next thing you know, they have a polio outbreak.
You just can't look at anything without the DDT polio theory being confirmed, no matter how you look at the data. It just keeps coming, you know. So when I had enough, I wrote an article, and I found that other people had actually already believed this, which was mobs Biskin and Scobie, these three people who are never referenced. There's no references to them, but I...
Yeah, can you tell us about who Biskin was and then, yeah, what you found that he was saying and how... Take us through that.
Well, his specialty was hormones, the hormone system, you know, and he was an MD, and he's deceased now, but he started writing in 1949. He had an article published in an Israeli medical journal. The DDT, he thought, was the cause of the polio epidemic. And then he wrote some other articles in pediatric journals. And then another, and he wrote some of these with a co-author named Mobbs. And then there was another author I found named Scobie.
Who's that?
Ralph Scobie. And he was more rigorous in going in detail, a lot of detail. The thing about Biskin is that he just had this sense of nobility and honesty, you know, and his logic and the way he wrote was really beautiful. But Scobie was, you could see how he was setting up documentation for history, for people to find him later, because he knew he was up against a big political hurdle. So he has these super referenced articles on how polio virus was politically prioritized and how any toxicological view of polio was being subverted, with tons of references, you know. So that was it. There's many potential causes or suspect causes over the centuries for polio. Arsenic, I have graphs for arsenic, graphs for lead. There's arsenic pesticides, lead pesticides, and then there's the chlorine pesticides. And I have all these together, and they map out, and they match up with polio incidents, you know. But the mainstream medicine avoided some extremely obvious toxicological suspects. And that indicts them.
The crucial experiment was not done in polio. But they got, instead they found a virus and claimed the virus to be the cause of polio. And then the vaccination business started and then the thing was gone. Another Nobel Prize and the thing was gone.
What was the crucial experiment?
The crucial experiment would be to show with this virus they claimed to cause polio in humans, to do an experiment in animals to cause this paralysis, and that was not done.
When the electron microscope was invented in the late 20s, the people in this area of research, they said, oh, this is a great tool. Now we're going to look and maybe we can find something that we couldn't see with the previous microscopes, because this could see things much, much smaller, the electron microscope. And then it was really exciting when they saw all these particles. And they were like, one of these particles must be the virus. And so they did all of these purification experiments where they took the fluid or tissue from a sick person and they tried to purify out the particles. And they couldn't. They could not be successful with identifying a particle. And one of the big things they said is, well, we can't tell if the particles are just from the dying tissue or from something else. Never could differentiate that, so they were pretty much about to give up on the whole field when Enders came along and when they made this polio vaccine that was a commercial success.
Enders, he said, look, I'm not using bacteria, but I use tissue, flattened the tissue, and put seemingly infected material on it. And if it's dying, that is possibly the proof that it's transforming itself into viral matter. But that was self-deception, because what he didn't realize, because he and all followers never did control experiment, was that he was using highly toxic antibiotics in order to keep the bacteria out, and he was starving them. And they were using fetal sera to feed them, and it's fully full with microbes, with nucleic acid of all vice kind of living, you know, it's not sterile. So the condition, what they were using to prepare the cells for the control experiment, are the very same conditions making them die. And they didn't realize it because they never performed control experiment. They're the same amount of proteins, but sterilized, you know, and to see what happened. Never ever they carried out this. And they were not wondering why they can't isolate the virus. They were convinced the dying of the cell must be caused by a virus. This was the assumption out of their faith that there must be a virus which is responsible for this or that kind of diseases. And therefore, they were fooling themselves and fooling the public. And what happened, that in this very paper, 1st June 54, John Franklin Enders and his co-author, they are writing, take care about these preliminary findings, because sometimes our culture is dying even if we do nothing with them. So it can be that an unknown virus is inside or unknown factors. And we...
Sorry, you mean be careful?
Not make assumptions. And he warns the audience or the readers that this has been proven, and it has to be proven if this system in the lab has something to do with real measles, you know. This is in this paper. You see it on your own, just read it. But half a year later, he received the Nobel Prize for another idea out of the old virology on poliovirus, that the virus should not be specific to his tissues. And this Nobel Prize made him blind. And this speculative paper of 1st June 54 became, in the same moment he received the Nobel Prize, it became a scientific fact which never ever is possible to question. I mean, the Nobel Prize, it's more worth in the field of science than the words of 100 popes together, definitely. If you receive the Nobel Prize, that's such a great thing, and that's the definite proof that it's important and true and scientific what you did. So from a Nobel Prize for an idea out of the falsified paradigm of virology, this made a scientific fact from this paper and became the whole basis, not only for measles virology, but for the whole field of virology. When they culture a virus, then they said, look, we isolated it, we have it, it's multiplying, and we have all parts of the virus. And what they are doing, they took out proteins and add them mentally together to a model of something which they never could show that it exists, never able to isolate it, and of course never ever being able to show it inside a human being, in animal, or in a liquid, in sperm, in blood, you know, nowhere. All photographs shown and claimed those are particles are very highly manipulated structures of dying cells in a test tube.
About 8 months after my article on polio was published, a biochemist, Howard Ernovitz, looked into the idea of polio isolation. He found the famous studies claiming to have isolated poliovirus were actually false. That if you read the studies, that they didn't do much, you know, their idea of what they call an isolation of poliovirus was actually not much more than putting some feces in water and blending, and then putting that into a centrifuge to separate the clear liquid from the feces. And this clear liquid they declared was a virus, isolated virus, you know. So that's obviously patently false, and he discovered that. He went through several studies. Well, if you can't isolate a virus, or isolate anything, in fact, you can't know what it is or what it does or what its function is. You have to be able to conceive something as a separate entity in order to understand it. And they can't isolate viruses. They can look at mixtures, and they can claim that they have a virus isolated there, but the only thing they did in terms of isolation is redefine the word isolate as a mixture. So they took a word and turned it upside down. And they run around telling people they isolated a virus, but all they did is find a mixture which they claim a virus is in. That's all the virologists are doing. They're basically reinventing language.
So this was the paper that was got the Nobel Prize for discovering how to isolate a virus. And it was done with measles. So they say they swabbed the throat and immersed the swab in 2 milliliters of milk. The first thing that's curious about that is if you're looking for a particle of genetic material from the measles person, you wouldn't want to mix it with milk, which has genetic material of its own. But that's what they did. Then the culture medium consists of bovine amniotic fluid, 90%, beef embryo extract, 5%, and horse serum, 5%. Now these are all three different sources of rich genetic material. Now sometimes they use different animal embryonic fluid or human embryonic fluid or something, but it's always some combination. So now we have 5 sources of genetic material. We have milk, beef embryo amniotic fluid, beef embryo extract, bovine serum, and monkey kidney tissue. And then they add penicillin and streptomycin. Now they add amphotericin and gentamicin, which interestingly are nephrotoxic drugs, meaning poisonous to the kidneys. So in other words, they break your kidney tissue down. And then they add soybean trypsin inhibitor. And so then the whole thing breaks down into millions of pieces of genetic material. And that's called an isolated virus. Now, here's an interesting thing. When the guy who came up with this method, which is exactly the method that all these papers today use, they take lung fluid, mix it with 4 or 5 different sources of genetic material, inoculate that on kidney tissue, poison the kidney tissue with specific nephrotoxic, kidney toxic drugs. And by the way, they sometimes say we use gentamicin instead of penicillin because we get a better yield of the virus. Because penicillin is not so damaging to the kidney tissue. Gentamicin is more damaging, so you get a better breakdown of the stuff. And then they say the evidence that it was a virus that killed the monkey kidney tissue is so-called cytopathic changes. In other words, the kidney tissue broke down. But here, in the paper that got the Nobel Prize, it's from John Enders, he says, a second agent was obtained from uninoculated culture of monkey kidney cells. The cytopathic changes it induced in the unstained preparation could not be distinguished with confidence from the viruses isolated from measles. So the translation of that is we did a control, and so instead of starting with something from somebody with measles, we started with nothing. And the breakdown we got was the same. Now, if you let that sink in a minute, what he just told you is it had nothing to do with anything from somebody with measles. It had to do with the way that we broke down the tissue. In other words, he just disproved that there was something from a measles person that caused these changes in the kidney tissue. And then he goes on as if he didn't prove that, but then he says later, in the follow-up paper, Ruckel has lately reported similar findings, and in addition has isolated an agent from monkey kidney tissue that is indistinguishable from human measles virus. In other words, he just told you that the particles that you get from the breakdown of the monkey kidney tissue are indistinguishable from what he's calling measles virus. In other words, that's where the particles came from the breaking down of the tissue. He just proved that there was no infecting agent in this mixture, because it's the same whether you start with measles or not.
This has been the standard type of cell culture they've done since that time, 1954, much. But they use that cell culture to manufacture a vaccine, because they take the fluid out of the toxic cell culture, and essentially that is a live virus vaccine. So Enders won the Nobel Prize for these efforts and related to this research, and also helping to develop the polio vaccine. And that changed the whole way that this this paper was interpreted. Now suddenly it was taken as a way to prove the existence of a virus, because they could repeat it. So they could pretty much take any fluid from any sick person with any disease that they say is viral. They could do it with other diseases, but they didn't, because they only wanted to use this to talk about viruses, and put it in this recipe of the toxic cell culture with, you know, toxic antibiotics, and they usually use ones that are specifically toxic to the type of cells in the culture. So when they use kidney cells, they use antibiotics like streptomycin, gentamicin, and amphotericin B, which are all specifically toxic to the kidneys. They starve the culture, and then they add other biological materials like bovine calf serum, like a fetal bovine serum rather, like from, you know, calves in the womb, their blood. And they can show these what they call cytopathic effects, which is damage to the cells from this every single time. And then when cells are damaged, they make particles like exosomes and apoptotic bodies and other types of particles that don't even have names. And they can just point to whatever particle they want and say, there's the virus. So it's very convenient. It just doesn't come close to proving what they say it does. And so the fact that Enders helped manufacture this polio vaccine and created this technique, you know, this tissue culture experiment, you know, the so-called virus isolation, it's not just the way to, you know, discover a new virus. It's also the way to manufacture a new vaccine. So this is a commercial experiment, right? Now, they've changed that paradigm. They're changing it now. Okay, but for the last 50 years, every virus vaccine was manufactured and created in this way. This one experiment both prove a new virus and manufacture a new vaccine. It's very, very convenient. And you can see that it fits perfectly in the vaccine business model.
Next thing you know, they're vaccinating children with polio.
And if you remember, there were two vaccines for polio. There was first the Salk vaccine, and that caused a lot of illness, and it was taken off the market. It was considered unsafe. And then, like 3 years later, they introduced the Sabin vaccine. So if you look at, you know, when the vaccines were developed and when they were actually utilized, because like the Salk vaccine, only a very small number of people got it. you'll see that polio went away before there was any vaccine that people were getting. And it was basically when they stopped using DDT and lead arsenate that it went away.
And then, by the way, with polio, before the vaccine, you had to, I always have trouble getting this right, you had to have symptoms for a day, and you were called polio, like paralysis. After the vaccine, you had to have symptoms for, I think it was 6 months continuously, to be called polio. So since 95% of the children resolve on their own, they just detoxify it, the incidence of polio goes way down because of the vaccine, because they changed the definition of how long you had to be paralyzed in order to be diagnosed with polio. So immediately the next month, the polio diagnosis is gone, and now they have something called acute flaccid paralysis, which there was in the last 10 years in India, I think it was 497,000 cases of acute flaccid paralysis, which means something acute happens and then you get paralyzed. That's the definition of polio. But now they don't call it polio because they're vaccinated, and they call it acute flaccid paralysis, and then we're good.
And, you know, I think it was, there was a big commercial aspect, because, you know, this vaccine, the polio vaccine, I mean, people don't realize that if you go back to vaccines that were much earlier, people did not want them. People fought against them. They did not want their kids, even just an injection. It was extremely unusual that anyone would be subjected to an injection. It was seen, you know, as an unsafe thing to actually purposely pierce your skin with a sharp implement and put something in. So when they had like the earlier vaccines, like the diphtheria serum that they were trying to give and things like that, parents were not interested in doing this to their children. They had to like come up with all these like marketing campaigns to convince anyone. But polio was so scary and devastating because every summer, you know, there'd be kids getting paralyzed and dying, and those images with the iron lung. People were so afraid this for the first time they were willing, they were almost, you know, desperate for something, and that was the first really successful vaccine commercially, even though it actually had nothing to do with stopping polio. There was the public perception that it was. And even when I went to medical school, that was still held up as the shining example of the miracle of vaccines was polio.
People have sent me in this past year, let me just take a guess, 50 papers called The Isolation of SARS-CoV-2. Now, maybe 48, but, you know, it's a lot. And the, you know, both the normal virology community and the sort of alternative community sends me paper after paper saying, here's how they isolated, here's a paper showing the isolation of this virus. Every single one did it the exact same way.
They did the tissue culture experiment developed by Enders. The same one that is in every single paper that claims virus isolation. They don't do any other method. They might vary a little thing here and there, but they're doing the same exact experiment.
They take snot and they inoculate it onto tissue culture, usually monkey kidney cells, which are called zero cells. Now, you could take any other culture, like human cells or chick embryo cells or whatever, and try that. And that's how they prove that the virus exists, and that's what they call isolation, and that's how they prove that it kills tissue.
The same, only with a little bit of changes. And as they are using sometimes a little bit different cell cultures, they say, look, we have another type of virus, another proteins, another vaccine, but in the end, they are doing exactly the same, exactly the protocol of Enders.
Now, somebody could say, well, but 63 years later, surely we can distinguish the breakdown of, like, our tissue or monkey kidney tissue from an exogenous virus, right? So here's a article that was in Viruses May 2020. They're talking about now they have a better name for just debris from coming from the breakdown of our tissues. They call it extracellular vesicles and exosomes. But that means when we get poisoned or sick, then we break down into these particles. And the question of this article was, can we tell the difference between this breakdown versus something coming from outside, right? So he says, quote, however, to date, a reliable method that can guarantee a separation from extracellular vesicles and exosomes from viruses, quote, does not exist. We can't tell the difference. And essentially what that means is, all of these genetic pieces that we're calling viruses are just the breaking down of our own tissue. And if we get poisoned or sick, by the way, I didn't say in this culture experiment, if you take snot from measles or COVID patient, mix it with bovine serum, et cetera, and then inoculate it on kidney tissue and put antibiotics in it, it still doesn't break down. You have to starve the tissue, what they call minimal nutrient medium. In other words, if you take a tissue and feed it like good tissue food, you know, like sugar and amino acids, you can't get it to break down by putting a measles virus, even a measles virus and antibiotics, I mean, to break down a little bit, but not much. So they learned that they have to starve the tissue first, and then it breaks down. And they don't do a control by saying, what if we just feed it normal tissue food, and then it doesn't break down? So it must have been the fact that we starved it.
And this is how they are fooling themselves. And only because they are working inside scientific institutions or with tools, technical tools you can really do science with, they think it's science. We are just following the things. But the first duty of a scientist, and to claim that something is scientific, it's to question it. And to question it and yourself. That's a written duty. And because, and only if you cannot falsificate your theory and your finding, and you show that the method you used, it's not inducing the result, then you can speak out about the scientific matter.
Well, I am, by training, a clinical psychologist and a historian of science. I did a PhD in clinical psychology in Basel and a PhD in history and theory of science in Vienna. And history of science is kind of my scientific hobby and has been all the time. How do the social powers that shape science interact to produce facts? And I think the core element of a historically informed theory of science is about understanding the social forces that shape facts. Normally people think facts are out there, like flower pots standing on the balcony. But scientific facts are not flower pots standing on the balcony. Scientific facts are constructs, highly complex constructs that are being produced by people who look at facts, by people who want the facts to be in a certain way, by economic powers that want to gain money from the facts, and everything together, that is a scientific fact. And that's what interests me.
I ran into the Federal Minister of Justice in Germany. She was very often to my village, Langenhagen, and so she rang me later, and she still was member of the parliament and in the back scene, influential, you know, person. People were listening to her, and she asked me if I have new proof, you know, disproving the existence of measles virus, because there were all the rumors that we need obligation to get vaccinated against measles, which materialized already by the end of last year. And she asked me if I have proofs of that the Robert Koch Institute has no proof. And therefore, easy, I said, look, I am offering 100,000 euro for a person being able to show me a scientific publication of the Robert Koch Institute, because they are obliged by law to do research on all kinds of viruses causing disease. That's their duty. And I knew they have no publication on the measles virus. They publish photos and text on this, but it's not published scientifically. So no description how this photo derived, how they did it, who did it, and no, nothing. And this I knew. And so I went public with this.
Well, this was actually serendipity, I would say. I one day heard about him having put out that prize, right? Anybody who is able to show him a measles virus or a publication that produces valid information about a measles virus would receive, I think, 100,000 euros, something like that. I found that very, very funny because, like everybody else, I thought, well, what's that? I mean, everybody knows there is measles. I've had it when I was a child. People are being vaccinated against it. So why would you want to ask for a measles virus? And so I looked into that, and I've actually phoned him, made contact with him, and asked him. And he said, well, it's very simple. There is no definitive proof out in the scientific literature that there is such a thing as a measles virus. And I found that very interesting from a social scientific point of view, because I thought, how could that be? And so I followed that up, and I asked him what happened, and then he said one doctor, I think he was associated with the German skeptics community, sent him 7 or so publications, and he sent them to me to see what it was. As you probably know, or as is known by now, is in the first trial, he lost, so he didn't pay the money.
The specialist, the court's specialist, asked by the court to examine those 6 papers, he said none of them have a proof for existence of a virus. But, he said, arguments taken out and put together, basically together, are delivering the proof for the existence of the virus. And therefore, I was sentenced.
But then he went to the courts a second time, and then he was actually vindicated. And the judge said, well, there has not been produced a definitive proof of a measles virus.
What happened, there was a new judge from the 3, and she was directly coming from university after her PhD, and she was thinking logically. She asked him, Dr. Lanka is questioning that there, in those 6 papers, there are no control experiments. And very interesting, he, in his written statement, said in 2 statements, sure, the control experiments are there, but visibly, they are not there. There's no chapter on control experiments.
So he cheated.
He cheated. So what happened when the specialist admit to the question, if now the control experiments are carried out, and if we can really speak of a scientific papers, all of them 6, because they are only scientific if control experiments carried out. And he said, and it was still, it's still in the protocol, it's there. He said, none of those 6 papers includes negative controls. And that means they are not scientific. And all the journalists, they were so disappointed. They were happy being at the Lake Constance, hanging around, you know, and the process should go on for a long, long, you know, period, you know, but then it was, and everybody, it's not possible. They were shocked. Then on the high court level in Stuttgart, I won.
And when I looked at those 7 publications, which that guy had sent in as purported proof, I was really astonished to see what I would say a good indication that there was something going on, but certainly not a proof. And I talked to Lanka and said, well, how can that be? Why didn't he present a better type of material? And Lanka said on the phone, well, there is none. And I guess there is indeed none. And when I found that out, I went to see a professor of virology, of infectiology in Leipzig, who is really a very smart person, and talked at length to her. And she confirmed there is not really a very definitive proof of that.
It's this one-dimensional fear-mongering model. So the one-dimensional model, this is also far from reality, that there's one disease and one cause and only one possibility to fight it. So you have one disease and the only cause is the virus, and then every other possible cause is excluded, and then you can only fight it with drugs and vaccines. So then you have this fear mongering. You need it to make it look very scary. And
now the irony of this whole thing is when you get down to, so how do you make this particle called a virus? It's clear. You starve and poison tissue, and it breaks down into a virus. Well, it's not a virus, but a genetic thesis, which we call misconception, called a virus. So the same thing. How do you make a person sick? You starve and poison them, and then they break down into these pieces, and we call it a virus, and we say they're sick. Same thing.
But at the end of the day, people want to know, how do I stay healthy? What do I, you know, everybody's telling me to be terrified of coronavirus. They're telling me to be terrified of AIDS. We don't know when Ebola is going to come next. I've seen movies with people in these spacesuits worried about this Ebola. And how do we, what's your take on all of that? How do people integrate that? How do they deal with all of this?
Well,
how do they think about it?
Let me tell you what, from my research on Ebola. Well, let's start with that first. I don't want people assuming something that they ought not to assume. I am convinced the Ebola thing is a total, complete hoax. One thing that Americans, some people, especially people who are not Americans, they always get a kick when I say this. But I said, so funny, here in the United States, we always get these plagues that come from China, come from Africa. We never have a red, white, and blue one, you know, epidemic. They always come from somewhere else. When I did this thing for John Rappaport on Ebola, and I looked in there, and all the original papers on Ebola, there's the classic thing, nobody isolated a virus. No. No, it's not done. I've still got those papers and everything. Right? That I sent them all to John Rappaport. And then I looked up and I read these things about the so-called outbreaks and things like that, about where they happened. One of the big Ebola outbreaks happened in a mine, an abandoned mine. Only the people that went down in that mine came back with these horrible disease. You know, supposedly it's an infectious virus that they should have been able to transmit to other people. Of course, that didn't happen. The other people that were in the area and the people that met the people that came back out of the mine that eventually became sick, none of them got sick. And, of course, this mine had been abandoned for a long time. I think it was a gold mine. Guess what toxic chemicals they use in gold mining, like arsenic and stuff like that. I mean, you know, you have this abandoned place. Who knows what all kinds of toxic chemicals and things were down in there, heavy metals and stuff, and what they were breathing and all this kind of crap. These people got sick. I don't dispute the fact that they got sick and had problems. But why didn't all the people above ground, you know, get them? Why was that the place that they were talking about an Ebola outbreak? You know, where are your other examples of an Ebola outbreak, you know? Where's the little village, you know, where they're spreading this stuff around? And it was in the midst of one of those interminable wars. These wars that go, this was in the Congo, I believe it was. I think that was the country that we were talking about in this gold mine. They had these battles, these wars going on all the time. The Congo is one of the richest resource countries in Africa. And Africa is loaded with resources. The West wants those resources. They want to take them any way they can. And Papua New Guinea, where I was a Peace Corps volunteer there, it's an island, the only island bigger than it is Iceland. And it's huge amount of resources. It has oil oozing out of the soil. You can see it. And I was in the highlands. You know? Yeah. And they have minerals. They have all sorts of stuff. A great place. The healthiest people I ever met in my life. Absolutely healthiest people I ever met in my life for these Papua New Guineans. This should be important for people. Glad I even reminded myself about this. I was teaching high school there. And I noticed nobody's wearing glasses. No students. I went to the headmaster one day and I said, I guess the students don't, there aren't students wearing glasses because they're just too poor. He said, no, they don't need them. In fact, nobody needed glasses. They were so healthy, strong, capable people. They've been there for 30 or 50,000 years. Nobody knows how long they've been there. These people have been there, you know. And they knew how to take care of themselves. I have a feeling that the people on this continent before the Europeans showed up, I know what I read from some of the what the missionaries wrote about the North American Indians. They weren't the Spaniards. They might have been the British people that wrote about them. I have a feeling that the North American Indians were like the Papua New Guineans, extremely healthy people. Because that's what they wrote about how healthy and strong and sturdy these people were, you know?
Well, this is really what I want to try to capture, and it's so obvious, but I want to kind of remind people that we are being sold a vision where health is delivered to you by technology.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. I know. How do we exist on this planet for hundreds of thousands of years before the white jacketed people showed up? You know. I almost accept nothing that's become mainstream about health. Almost nothing anymore.
The whole thing cooked up again in the BSE time when people thought it might be possible that the mad cow disease. But indeed, it was also in the intoxication of the cow was the cause of mad cow disease, because they got they changed the law in Great Britain that the farmers should do higher dosage of this forced meat on the neck of the cows because of the warble fly, which was a disease which damaged the cows, and the milk wasn't good enough, so they said what the farmers had to do some more phosmate on the necks, and the phosmate is organophosphate, and if you get much enough to your nervous system, then you get this problems with your axons, and you get the neuropathy, and that's the true cause of the cow disease. And well, they noticed that because they had investigations and they had a commission there, and they noted about the problem of phosphate, and they changed the law again. So they said, well, it might be possible that there's a connection. And since they have the lower dose again, the mad cow disease is not anymore there.
Throughout medical history, whenever we've seen a group of symptoms move through a community or different cities, we've only attributed it to an infectious illness. We have never stopped to consider what other things could be going on in the health of these people in these communities. We've never stopped to consider toxins that were sprayed in the air, toxins that were sprayed on the food, toxins that were put into the water. We've never stopped to understand nutritional deficiencies, vitamin C deficiencies, vitamin D deficiencies, B vitamin deficiencies, and what that looks like when stressors affect the community. And as a result of those stressors, people start expressing symptoms. We've never attributed the onset of infectious diseases to other environmental issues, like clean water, dirty water, sewage systems, no sewage systems, crowded living conditions, better living conditions, war, poverty, starvation. These are all factors that if we dig into the history books, we know that many of the infectious illnesses are really manifestations of any one or many of the things that I just listed that are dietary and environmentally driven. That's a problem. Because we have huge amounts of literature to show other potential causes of the expression of what looks like infectious diseases, but actually are not. I mean, there's such an easy way to practice Western medicine without using pharmaceutical drugs. But the basis behind medical education is the use of drugs. It's the cornerstone of Western medical practice. Pharma, drugs, injections,
you know, this is not the first time with polio that the entire medical community has mistaken a illness for being an infection. Because that's the problem with this epidemiological proof. Meaning, so here you had sailors on a boat. One after another got sick. They would go to the port, and then the next sailors got sick. And of course, everybody thought they were spreading one thing to the next person. And then somebody ate a lemon or a lime, and the whole thing went away, and they said, well, it must be scurvy, vitamin C deficiency. That happened with beriberi and pellagra for, you know, decades, if not centuries. These simple nutrient deficiencies, you know, when, I'm not an expert on this, but one of them is if you don't soak your corn properly, right? Native people, they soaked corn and even put ashes in it, and it's called nixtalization or something, and that makes the B vitamins more available. So the people in the South didn't know that, so they just ate corn, and then they died of, I think, pellagra or beriberi, one of the two, because one of the B vitamins is not available, and then you get sick. And because it happened in families, right, because this family ate a lot of corn and that family ate potatoes, and they didn't get sick. And so they said, well, it must be something spreading in the family. That's exactly the problem with using epidemiology to determine causation. It's just, as really everybody admits, it's inappropriate.
I just wanted to add something, I think, because I think it's very important. I think what is also important to note is that the idea of the modern, highly industrialized societies we are living in, and I think the message of this society is that nature is not enough, and that you need the modern man to improve it. That's the idea behind Monsanto and so many other things and industries. And I think that's what is in so many people's minds of today, that they think that we need the. And the technology of modern man to solve our problems. And this is why now they believe that there's a pandemic, and so of course there's only one solution, the technology of modern man, but they do not think anymore and the possibility that there can be other solutions and solutions that and that the modern technology is not the solution, it's maybe even causing the problems we are trying to solve.
only, and you know, I've now got to the point where if somebody says, is there enough epidemiology to investigate whether COVID is an infection? I say yes. I don't need to hear another story about how Aunt Bessie went singing and got sick. I get it. So let's investigate whether it's a virus. We did. It's not. Move on. You know, I don't need any more stories. That is not how any scientist determines causation. Period.
Well, hello, everybody. That was the Viral Delusion Part 2 that we just wrapped up playing here. And there was a Michigan caller that called in a couple of times but then dropped, probably checking to see if the clip was still playing or not. But so that was Part 2. It really presents some pretty interesting information. I mean, it's almost like saying something is a virus is the default. I think that's kind of like an easy cop-out, right? If you don't know exactly what's causing something, causing a particular illness or disease, blame it on a virus, right? And then talking about actually identifying a virus, it's pretty compelling. It's one of those things where, okay, you know, you kind of got to start questioning all of it. And if the same methods are used to identify something as a virus, you know, and they're all playing by the same playbook, and that playbook isn't exactly accurate, like not having control groups, like the fact that, you know, what they were talking about with, in order to actually try to identify it, they had to actually starve and poison. And they were talking about the monkeys, you know, the monkeys couldn't get sick with anything. So they literally drilled a hole in their head, you know, exposed them to stuff, which then causes breakdown of the cells and stuff. And then, oh, looky here, now we've identified the virus. And going all the way back to polio and things like that. And I haven't watched all five of these. I'm actually, trying to save watching it for when I am actually going to be playing them. Like I said, with part one, I got about halfway through it, and I was like, wow, this is really interesting stuff. I want to play this whole series now. And I wonder if, you know, I don't know. I'll have to look at, you know, just kind of take a sneak peek at, you know, parts 3, 4, and 5, if they go into other things, like smallpox, like now monkeypox, right? All these things that are attributed to viruses. What else could it possibly be, right? And now we have the advent of, you know, we've had chemtrails, what used to be considered, oh, that's just conspiracy theory, that's not really a thing. But we know now that it absolutely is a thing. They're releasing all kinds of who knows what the hell chemicals into the air all the time over cities. We have weather modification. Some of it's that, some of it, who knows, aluminum and dispersing who knows what chemicals. And, I mean, how do we even know if, like, we're part of an experiment that we don't even, that we're not even aware of, right? Maybe they're trying to see, okay, what happens if we put this crap into the air, all over cities, all over the world and stuff, then what effect does it have? And if that effect is people suddenly start getting sick and their cells are breaking down, which means the breakdown of DNA and RNA in the cells and stuff, and then they all become particles, then they can easily say, oh, looky here, here's a virus, when it might not be a virus. And so it's really kind of compelling. It really gets you to start thinking outside of the box as far as what we believe to be so true with some of these diseases that are attributed to viruses. And when the science says, yes, this is a virus, I've isolated it, da-da-da-da-da, did they really? You know? what is causing it? What is causing that breakdown to begin with? That genetic material to start breaking down, and maybe even mutating, right? What's cancer? Well, you know, cancer is basically mutated cells, right? Something goes haywire and cancer starts to grow, which is basically mutated cells. And that's why some cancer tumors, I mean, they'll have teeth growing and cancer tumors in their stomach or all kinds of weird stuff, right? Because the cells have been damaged or mutated and they're growing and something just went haywire. And so hopefully this series will continue on and start talking about some of these other diseases like AIDS, like, you know, it's talked a little bit about measles in this part. Let's get into smallpox. Let's get into monkeypox. All these things and start questioning, you know, if what we know is so true, you know, if it's the truth, then how do we really know it's the truth, right? Especially with that 100,000 euro bet of showing, you know, showing the guy definitive proof of a virus. Definitive, it's been isolated. I mean, we have electron microscopes now. I mean, and we should be able to, with the technology we have, to take real photographs of a virus, take a blood sample and find that virus, right? We should be able to do that. Not these CGI pictures. I mean, when you see the coronavirus, it's just a CGI photo of what scientists think it looks like. It's not an actual, they're not actually showing you a picture of it. So we got to start putting our thinking caps on. And let's see. So anyway, if you're out there and you're listening and you want to talk, the number is 563-999-3698. And if nobody presses one to raise their hand, then I'm almost tempted to go on and play part three, because part three is an hour, 3 minutes long, and there's an hour, 34 minutes left of this live broadcast. So it would still be something that I could play, and there would still be time later, because I am kind of curious about part three. And so since we don't have anybody calling in, raising their hand right now, I'm very tempted to play it, just because I'm curious myself on it. Although, of course, I don't have the part three link in the show description. I'll have to add it after the fact if I do play it. But if you're looking at the show description and you click on the link for part 2 of 5, it shouldn't be too difficult to locate part 3 on the same channel there on Rumble and find it. So I am tempted. I'm going to give it a little bit more time to see if anybody calls in and raises their hand, 563-999-3698. And, of course, there's always interesting stuff going on in the news that we can talk about, or I could play this clip, and then if anybody calls in, wants to call in at the very tail end of the show, we could do that, because, like I said, the part 3 is 1 hour and 3 minutes long. I have 1 hour and 32 minutes left of the show, so that gives a pretty good amount of time for people to call in during that last, 25 minutes or so of the show to chat and talk and go into overtime if we want to. But if not, I'm cool with that. End the show and talk about our evenings and that kind of thing, of course. Tune in for Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne Show, the regular show on Sundays, 6 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. This Sunday, I do not have a guest, and I'm still without a co-host. So it's going to be a free-for-all call-in, let's talk, probably play a shorter clip or two, the usual ones that are only like, 5, 10, maybe 15 minutes to talk about and see what's going on in the news and things. As a matter of fact, I think I will start playing part 3. And I guess I could always cut it off if I wanted to. But I am kind of curious. I'm actually going to go over to my browser and queue up part 3 because I'm kind of curious to see where they go with this. With this next part and the stuff that they get into, and these people that are being interviewed, they're really presenting some good information to get you thinking. Even if it's totally wrong, at least get it to thinking, right? Or maybe it's not so wrong. Or maybe, it's just got to question everything because we can see the motivation. There's a huge financial motivation to blame a disease on a virus instead of blaming it on the crap that they're putting in our food, the GMO foods, the crap that's spraying in the air, chemtrails, the crap that's in our water that we're drinking that can't be filtered out. Especially if you're drinking tap water, you need to get your filter because it's really truly scary to think about drinking water straight from the tap. Scary thought. So yeah. So since there's nobody raising their hand here on the switchboard, I'm gonna go ahead and kick off part 3. 1 hour, 3 minutes long. Might even play around with trying to pause it because I think on the switchboard when I'm playing a clip, I can't just pause it. It'll just start from scratch again. So I'm going to do a little bit of an experiment here to see if it actually does pause or not. I'm wondering if that might have changed. It never has, but then I haven't tried it for a long time either. So I'm going to just kind of play it for a few seconds, and then I'm going to pause it, and we'll see if it actually pauses or if it starts from square one again. So here we go with the experiment. 3, 2, 1, the viral delusion, part 3. But I'm going to pause it after a few seconds just to see if it actually pauses or if it resets to the beginning.
Every time you go back and look at what happened with this epidemic or that, there's always some sort of poisoning or some sort of toxin or some sort of, even psychological change.
Okay, so I paused it, and the counter did go back to 0 like I expected it would. So thanks for hanging in there with me while I did that experiment. The thing on the switchboard is kind of confusing because it, you know, it has a little play button, and then once you push play, then it has a pause, the symbol for pause. But it doesn't actually pause it. It stops it. I don't know why Blog Talk does that. Don't give icon for pause when it doesn't actually pause it. It stops it and reverts back to the beginning again. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and kick this off for real this time and not pause it. And then, again, if you're out there and you want to call in, 563-999-3698. And there's an hour, 27 minutes left of the live broadcast. This clip is an hour and 3 minutes, so that should give us at least the last 20 minutes for people to call in and talk if they want. So I'm going to go ahead and kick this off. 3, 2, 1, and launch.
Every time you go back and look at what happened with this epidemic or that, there's always some sort of poisoning or some sort of toxin or some sort of, you know, even psychological change in the people. They become victimized and powerless and subjugated and dominated, and then they end up sick.
When you say, when you look at past disease and there's always some kind of poisoning, some kind of toxin, can you sort of take us through that a little bit?
We went through that in the book. Sometimes it's basically even something like a comet coming in near the Earth's atmosphere and spewing nitrogen and sulfur gas all over. Next thing you know, everybody has the Black Plague. Every time you look, there is no evidence for a virus. Nobody saw a virus. There's not a shred of evidence. There's always some kind of either change in consciousness, and we downplay that because we don't understand how a change in consciousness or the way you think could actually produce illness. But and part of the problem here is because literally 99% of our research has been on viruses. Nobody looks into what actually otherwise causes disease. So the few times we have, like polio was caused by a combination of lead arsenic poisoning and DDT poisoning, both of which cause damage to the very part of our nervous system which is supposedly affected by the polio virus. So those are the ones that we've looked into, and we've actually identified the toxin that was the cause of damaging the people, including the children, which was mistaken for a virus. Now, many of them, nobody has looked into it, so we don't really know. I mean, Sally, the co-author, has spent a lot of time looking into this and has some very interesting correlations, I would say, with what might have happened back in, 1200 during the Black Plague. Because some of them, and I'm not an expert on this, but like there was, half the people in Iceland died from some plague that had to do with rats. It turns out they didn't have rats in Iceland until 200 years later. So bottom line is this theory that it was all microbes and infection and viruses is completely unsubstantiated. And every time that somebody does real science and looks into it, they find either some starvation situation, some toxic situation, or some big change in consciousness, like what happened to, for instance, the Native American or the Africans who were brought here.
Who remembers their school days, we were all taught that it was carried by infected rat fleas, you know, biting people and passing this dreaded disease on, which was supposed to kill tens of millions, well, all over the world, but particularly in Europe. And, you know, we all believe this and were taught this and for many years. When we looked into it, it was easy to see that it was nothing to do with infected rat fleas. And we looked at various angles on this, one of which was Professor Mike Bailey. And he was a dendrochronologist who looked at, well, he did several things. He looked at the period of the Black Death to see what tree rings would tell him, and he could see that during that period of the Black Death that the tree ring growth was much smaller. So you can tell by that that there was something going off in the environment for the trees not to have made any, you know, as much growth as they would normally. So to corroborate what that might be, he cross-referenced it with ice cores to see what was in the environment, and he could see that there was quite an environmental trough, that there was high levels of ammonium in the atmosphere, which is extremely toxic. And then he cross-referenced that with eyewitness accounts of the time, and the eyewitness accounts, people living through that, were talking about a stinking and choking atmosphere, and that people were just dropping down dead in the street, and also that the rivers and lakes were becoming polluted, and fish, shoals of fish, were floating to the surface, dead. Now, of course, this doesn't fit squarely with infected rat fleas, does it? Particularly fish all floating to the surface. So there's sort of a mass poisoning going on here. He also looked at earthquakes, and there was a lot of earthquakes around at that time, particularly a massive one in, I think it was the 25th of January 1348, if I remember right. Yeah. But a number of them. Well, whenever there's earthquakes and the earth opens up, particularly massive ones like that particular one, you get a lot of toxic substances and matter and fumes being released into the atmosphere. So this would start to account for why people were reporting these stinking and choking atmospheres, and supported by the ice core samples and the tree growth reduction. So there are also eyewitness reports of a comet coming into the Earth's atmosphere. People could see it. Now, whether that had anything to do with any debris from that, we don't know for sure. But what we do know from the eyewitness reports and the ice cores and all the rest of it, that the atmosphere changed drastically. There's also reports of, because the weather systems had changed drastically, there was very strange weather systems happening, so causing great loss of crops and great famines, particularly in Northern Europe, and people were having to migrate away because they could not sustain themselves. So people were dying for that reason as well. Again, we're back to lack of proper nutrition. In fact, the historians who've reported on it have said that the conditions in Northern Europe became so bad because of the crop failures that people were resorting to cannibalism. And there's written facts of this, so you can tell how bad things must have been. So all of these things together, all in this same time period, can account for this large death toll, but nothing to do with rat fleas. In more recent times, excavations in London have discovered, you know, they expected to be able to find evidence of large rat die-offs, because the infected fleas were supposed to kill the rats before they left the host that they'd killed and jumped onto human beings. This was the original story. But so there should have been huge die-offs, which one should have been reported by eyewitnesses at the time, should have been reporting lots of dead rats about, and there aren't any reports of that. And the archaeologists in more recent times were expecting to be able to find evidence of large rat die-offs. And again, there wasn't any in the ruins that they were looking at. So I think scientifically, people can dismiss this whole idea of infected rats, infected rat fleas. So the more probable cause is these climatic changes, which the eyewitnesses were reporting, and the ice cores and tree rings were supporting, of climatic changes, something happening in the environment in the in that period, which was causing a very toxic atmosphere that was actually poisoning people, as well as, of course, people starving to death because of crop failures. So this gives a much different picture of what the Black Death was. Again, nothing to do with germs and everything to do with all of these other factors.
Every time you go back and look at what happened with this epidemic or that, there's always some sort of poisoning or some sort of toxin or some sort of, you know, even psychological change in the people. They become victimized and powerless and subjugated and dominated, and then they end up sick.
Let's talk about one of the fallacies that we've all been taught about smallpox at school, about the invasion of South America by the conquistadors. I think this is a classic case of distorted history, let's say, and the lies we're told about through history. I mean, I'm sure most people will be aware that they're told that the conquistadors, we're looking in the 1500s now, Spanish conquistadors invaded South America, that the native populations all started to die out because of diseases brought across by the conquistadors, which the native populations of South America had no immunity to, and this is why millions of them died, and I do mean millions of them died out. And of course it says that's really unfortunate, but you know, that's just these horrible germs again responsible for killing the people. The real story is, I mean, if we think about it, there's some people say that the conquistadors had these diseases, smallpox being the main one, which they brought across the ocean with them. So our first thing was, well, if you want to believe in germs and you want to believe that the conquistadors had smallpox, they were already got it, why didn't they die on the ships? Because, you know, you don't... The journey across the Atlantic took a long time, you know, you didn't get there in a few days, so plenty of time for, if you've got smallpox, for you to develop it and die. So why didn't the conquistadors die on the ships? And then the medical establishment tried to say, oh, well, they'd obviously got immunity to it. Well, again, second load of nonsense, really. You know, if you've got smallpox, you've got smallpox. If you're immune to it, then you don't have smallpox, you know. This is using their basic germ theory model. So that's obviously a load of nonsense, and they're just trying to wriggle and try and find reasons to explain the fallacy. But when you look at what was really happening in South America when the conquistadors arrived, the people were dying, started to die, not because of any germs at all, but because of the way they were treated. The conquistadors were extremely barbaric, and their sole aim was to enslave the people and to steal the gold and silver. That's of the land. That's what they were there for. And they enslaved the population to work in the gold and silver mines to extract the gold and silver. But they treated the people so badly because they had such little respect for them that they didn't even bother to feed them, because their reasoning was that if they died, you know, they probably only last a few weeks. When they died, there were plenty more people that they could enslave to continue working in their mines. Hard to believe. But also, of course, they slaughtered, massacred great numbers of the local population, because they got steel weapons, they got even armored dogs, which they would root out people, track them down, chase them down, and would kill people. You know, if they were not in a condition that they could capture them and enslave them, the dogs would rip them to pieces. They're extremely barbaric. So the local population knew this and moved off their own land to escape from the conquistadors. But once they'd moved off their land, they now could not feed themselves properly. So they were dying of starvation, and they were dying, as we've said, all the conditions that befall people when they've not got proper nutrition, when they're under extreme stress. All of these things come into play, and as we've seen, smallpox, so-called smallpox, is one of the factors that starts to befall people when they're not being fed properly, when they're living in insanitary conditions. You know, these people are on the run, they're living under high stress. These are the things that befall them, nothing to do with the germ.
There's so much about the exploitation of the continent to extract the resources, specifically gold, certainly, and the extraction of gold requires the use of mercury to actually extract the gold from the ore. And so mercury being an extremely toxic substance, even if the people were healthy and they were fed, which rarely was the case, I mean it wasn't the case, that would have been, you know, pretty bad for their health. You know, it would have caused them adverse health effects. But the fact that they weren't cared for, they weren't fed, it made their lives extremely short. I mean, in some cases, you know, they barely lasted 3 months once they were put into the mines.
The records show that something like 50 million inhabitants of the South America and the islands died through one cause or another, but none of those things were to do with germs, in particular smallpox, which is the historians try to attribute to it, because no one wants to admit that it was the sheer barbarism of the conquistadors, the invaders, of what they did.
I mean, people say they died of measles, they died of smallpox, but there's no evidence for that. There's no evidence of any pathogen there. What there's evidence for is that they were poisoned, they were dispossessed, they were starved, they were humiliated, they were dominated, and even they were infested with bed bugs, which have their own kind of toxin that they bite into you. So there's much better explanations for what happened than some imaginary virus.
What we found with things like smallpox is that the rates of smallpox were directly attributable to the rate of insanitary conditions and poor dietary conditions. And wherever you see that, anywhere in the world, even today, wherever you see insanitary conditions and poor dietary conditions, you will see outbreaks of so-called smallpox. Once you take those insanitary conditions and provide proper nutritional food, the smallpox cases disappear.
As David said, the real reasons for the eradication of smallpox is due to improved health conditions, improved environmental conditions, improved living and living situation and plumbing and sanitary measures and improved improved diet. I mean, at the time before the 19th century, there were no sort of sanitation, as in sort of hygiene and sort of disposal of human waste, you know, so there was no sort of toilet systems and things, so indoor plumbing. And people were living amidst their own waste and bad water, animals around them, so there were... that was the cause of a lot of problems. Even though vaccination was brought in, there were two towns. There was Leicester, which is a place in England, and Cleveland in Ohio, that both had experiments where they implemented sanitation measures and they actually stopped vaccination. And they discovered the results of these measures that they implemented meant that the cases, what were called smallpox, reduced substantially. So the sanitation helped health, but it wasn't the vaccination, it was the eradication of vaccination that actually improved people's health.
there was a very eminent doctor, Charles Crichton, who believed in vaccination. He was asked to write the entry, I can't remember exactly what year, but the late 19th century, he was asked to write the entry for Encyclopedia Britannica for vaccination. And instead of just, as he said, you know, writing the, you know, the standard, you know, explanation within it, he decided to go back and actually have a look at it and look for himself. And he discovered, to his amazement, horror, whatever, that there was no scientific evidence behind the practice of vaccination, and he called it a superstition. He did write the entry for that particular year for vaccination, but he shocked his contemporaries, and because he was honest about what he found about vaccination, that there was no basis and it was a superstition, it was based on superstition. And as I say, he was an eminent physician of the time. Obviously, that's why he was asked to write the entry for Encyclopedia Britannica. But he certainly made it quite clear. He went back, had a look, and said, no, it's not based on evidence.
Conditions, and where here we're talking about decayed matter, not germs. So it's the, again, part of the four factors that we talk about. It's the lack of proper nutrition, sustained nutrition, lack of clean water, because it was always contaminated, and this everything being contaminated by basically toxins. And whenever those conditions were removed, as Dawn said, when they did that experiment in Leicester in England and Ohio in the United States, when they improved those living conditions, then the disease went away. And it's still the same today. If you look into the areas where there's an outbreak of so-called smallpox, you'll see that those very poor living conditions exist. And whenever those living conditions are removed, the so-called disease disappears, and it's nothing to do with vaccinations. In fact, as the English experiment showed, when they mandated for vaccinations, it actually increased the problem. It wasn't until they improved the living conditions of the people that the disease went away. From then and to this day, it's the vaccines. You can trace wherever vaccination programs have been put in place, they have never eradicated the disease they're supposed to eradicate, and you get, in actual fact, you can trace an increase in the disease. I mean, this happened in England in the late 1800s when they were the British government instituted compulsory vaccination for infants to get rid of smallpox. Yeah. Get rid of smallpox. So compulsory vaccination for infants, and they kept that in place for 40 years. Okay, so over that period, you know, they'd got to the stage where almost every individual in England had been vaccinated against smallpox, and yet during that entire period, the incidence of smallpox kept increasing. Not only the incidence of it, but the death rate. So, I mean, that proved two things, really. One is vaccination wasn't actually conferring immunity over that 40-year period. And it also gives a lie to the myth of
herd immunity, which we hear a lot about today, don't we? Well, obviously, clearly, if the vaccination worked and you could gain herd immunity from getting everybody vaccinated, then how can you still have a rise in incidents and deaths from smallpox? But that was what happened, and eventually they stopped doing it, but it took them 40 years to actually stop it, despite the protestations from many doctors of the time that realised vaccinations right from their outset was, well, they've used, like, you know, a filthy superstition, not based on any science at all. And these are doctors that are making these accusations, and it's still the same today. But in the early days, those doctors did have a voice and people could hear what they had to say. But now, of course, with the censorship that put out, shall we say, or enacted by the governments and mainstream media and places like Google and YouTube, the censorship is so much that those doctors, even though they're still around today, don't get a public voice.
In 2000, there was an article in Pediatrics Journal that actually looked at the death rates in children from birth to 19, from 1900 to 1998. And more specifically, children ages 1 to 19 who had horrible death rates from infectious diseases in the early 1900s were shown to have a very drastic reduction in the death rates from those infectious diseases by the mid-century. And the authors in the study point in two places in the study whereby they say the reduction in death from infectious diseases in children aged 1 to 19 was miraculous. It was exponentially observed to go down between 1900 and 1945, before vaccines and antibiotics were ever used. They then go on to say that the reason for the reduction in the death rate was due to proper water systems, clean water systems, proper sewage systems, better hygiene, improved living conditions. Twice, the authors state, and this was before vaccines and antibiotics were even available. And if you look at the infectious diseases, diphtheria, pertussis, measles, typhoid, influenza, the DPT vaccine didn't come out until 1949, diphtheria, pertussis, that. There was a diphtheria toxoid vaccine that was given in the 1920s. And I've actually seen experts show the marked reduction in the illnesses from diphtheria due to the introduction of the diphtheria toxoid vaccine. Not considering the fact that there were other factors that contributed to the reduction. And not considering the fact that all the other infectious diseases at that time also saw a marked reduction in the death rate, for which there were no vaccines. So the expert just leaves out the other information to put forth a narrative that it had to have been the diphtheria toxoid vaccine that did it. But it never mentions the fact that there were all these other infectious diseases that also saw the same rate of reduction of death without vaccines being implemented in society.
The historical curves, we show this in our book as well here, that the historical curves show that practically every disease
you can get a vaccine against.
The mortality of all infectious disease declines before vaccination.
The mass vaccinations became. So
it's true for tuberculosis, it's true for measles, it's true for diphtheria, it's true for polio, it's true for smallpox. They decline before the mass vaccinations came on the market. So that's not a proof for vaccination.
And what's, again, unfathomable for the human brain to consider is the idea that these infectious diseases were actually environmentally toxic caused. That it was due to water, poor water supplies, poor sewage supplies, poor living conditions, poor nutritional status, nutritional deficiencies. And so we only conclude that these people suffered from infectious diseases.
1918, so-called flu, no infectious agent was ever discovered and could never be proved to be the cause of the disease.
Really, the most well-done experiments that I've ever seen were Breslau's experiments in 1919 related to the Spanish flu. And there were actually a series of experiments done with humans and horses at that time that are published. And these were done as part of the United States Public Health Service. So that's the precursor to the CDC. So these were, you know, official studies. And they used some techniques that maybe are considered unethical today, because what they did was they had a group of prisoners, around 100, and they offered them that if they would do this experiment where they would expose themselves to the Spanish flu, which was, you know, obviously deadly, there were, you know, tens of millions of people to hundreds of millions of people who died depending on what data you look at. If they exposed themselves and did this experiment, they would earn their freedom. So they volunteered, and they went to, like, the basically ICU at a hospital in Boston or New England, and got these people with Spanish flu who were dying to basically, you know, they collected all their body fluids. They had them cough up stuff, you know, they collected snot from the nose. They even collected secretions from the eyes. And then they did three different experiments trying to get these healthy subjects sick with the Spanish flu. So they put the fluid into their mouth, nose, and eyes the first time, like transfer the fluid from the place in the sick people to the healthy people. Not one person got sick. They did it a second time where they injected it under the skin. Not one person got sick. That's kind of surprising, actually. And then they did a third experiment where they had them simulate close, intimate contact. So they had them, like, get really up, you know, in their personal space and had the sick person blow out and then the healthy person inhale their breath, and had them talk, like, really close for a period of time. And all three experiments, not one person got sick. They also did this in horses. And it might have been a different investigator, but like one of the experiments, they actually put like a bag over the nose of the horses that were sick, because horses get the flu also. And basically the horse, all the secretion filled up this bag and, you know, all their snot and stuff. And then they took this bag and they put it over healthy horse, had them breathe in all that stuff. The horses didn't get sick. They did another experiment, put it in their food. None of the horses got sick. So all these experiments for contagion didn't actually show any contagion.
So are you saying the Spanish flu is not contagious?
They've proven that it's not contagious, pretty much. And, you know, it also wasn't caused by a virus.
How do you know it wasn't caused by a virus?
Well, there's been no study that's ever shown a virus that caused it. Even Fauci wrote a paper that said most people actually died of bacterial pneumonia, but that wasn't what caused the epidemic either.
Because originally they thought, the medical establishment that is, originally they thought it was bacterial, but then changed their minds and thought it was a virus. But in both cases, of course, they were blaming some sort of infectious agent. That's the main thing.
And they tried to prove that. And we talk about that in the book, where they had these groups of volunteers stroke prisoners lined up, you know, with a group of people who were ill with the suspected flu, and a group of healthy people. And they had the unhealthy people cough and splash into the faces of the healthy people. They took mucus extracts from the unhealthy people and transplanted it into the healthy people. And they did this dozens of times, and not once, and I mean not once, were they able to transmit the so-called deadly flu to the healthy people.
Going on for 4 years, and it took its toll, not just physically for the men that were killed, it took its toll emotionally and mentally. And as we as David mentioned before, one of the four factors that causes people to be ill is prolonged emotional stress. Now, you can't get much more prolonged in emotional stress than being, you know, in a war for 4 years. I mean, not everyone was actually sustained the entire period. A lot of men were killed, but the war effort involved a lot of toxic materials. I mean, you know, knowing about the chlorine gas attacks, and didn't necessarily kill people, but it certainly weakened them, made them enfeebled, and certainly with their respiratory systems, it would have attacked their tissues and weakened them, and possibly other factors would have helped to cause their death.
You know, imagine being in a trench,
of disease in mud and water, and people are trying to kill you every day. Pretty stressful. Secondly, of course, the people in those wars were living on army rations, which were not nutritious. They were just basic, keep you alive, but were not feeding the body with proper nutrition. You know, you weren't getting plates of fresh fruit and vegetables. You know, you're just getting sort of like hardtack biscuits, you know, which you can chew on if you could not break your teeth. So very poor nutrition, very poor nutrition. So second factor, so you've got prolonged extreme stress, lack of nutrition.
Poor conditions in the trenches also include, you know, they obviously didn't have plenty of indoor plumbing, and there was obviously dead bodies around. They weren't always able to bury them. So, you know, you've got decomposing, putrefying bodies around.
So very insanitary conditions.
Very insanitary.
And as Dawn said, you know, with munitions, the materials used in munitions and explosives, extremely toxic. So it's not only the stuff they're handling, but the air would be filled with it when the shells, I mean, some of these bombardments went on for days, you know, so the air would have been filled with toxic gases from the exploding shells. You know, so if you weren't killed by an explosion, you'd probably die from the toxic output from these things. So that's the third of the four factors, okay? And then the final one, which is a little bit more mysterious, came into effect in the latter part of the war, and that was the telecommunications. So we're bringing in electromagnetic fields. Now we're talking 1917, going back, you know, before when they started to be erected, and particularly in some of the army camps in America, very powerful radio transmitters, okay, which put out extremely strong electromagnetic fields. And some of the early reports of people dying very quickly and mysteriously were in those camps. And when we investigated what it was, we found strange effects that people were dying of. And they died very quickly. You know, there wasn't what you normally assume, you know, a few weeks of feeling really rotten and then, you know, you slowly demise. People were just becoming ill within hours or a day and dropping down dead. And when they were examined, they were found they'd got hemorrhaging inside, internal hemorrhaging, particularly brain hemorrhages, which of course is something that no one would associate with influenza. But you do associate it with high-powered electromagnetic fields. And these sorts of cases were happening around these very powerful radio transmitters. And this could be traced into all sorts of areas of the world at that time, in that period. And quite some good work had been done on that in a book called The Invisible Rainbow by Arthur Furstenberg, which he goes into purely the electrical side of things.
At least in some geographic areas, there was a major new technology that was put out, and I'm talking about radar technology. And this put different kinds of electromagnetic radiation into the environment that biological organisms had never been exposed to before. And it's pretty clear that in various locations where this infrastructure was installed, that people had Spanish flu and other health outcomes.
And also, there was high-dose aspirin had been introduced, which is also, at the levels that it was given, extremely toxic.
Another factor that is often talked about and sort of fairly commonly talked about is the fact that all the soldiers were being given multiple vaccines.
Yes.
And quite often, there are quite a number of reports of soldiers, particularly in US military camps, that were vaccinated, never actually got out to active duty, that they died within the camps, but also even if they were made ill after vaccines, then they were in the army hospital in the camps, and they were given all sorts of treatment, including the kind of aspirin levels, and so they didn't stand a chance.
We found that these were the sort of factors, the combination of factors, that could be seen to be in effect in the so-called Spanish flu. It's all these anomalies put together and all these other indications that you can see there was something else going on, which then all got lumped together by the authorities and labelled a disease. Because when people look into it, you can soon start to point the finger at the authorities, lack of care, incorrect treatment, subjecting people to high levels of electromagnetic radiation. So questions could be asked and people could get sued, and so it's much better to blame it on a disease than it is to admit the truth. And this, we found this happens a lot, and as someone once said, it's much better to blame a virus, because you can't sue a virus. And that's probably a very true word, you know. But you can sue chemical companies and military organizations and pharmaceutical companies with high-dose aspirin and all the rest of it. They can be sued. So much better not to talk about that and to talk about a virus being the cause of it instead.
You know, partly they were, the same people who were promoting this. We're talking Rockefeller and... they were changing the medical curriculum so that it was all based on the germ theory and its offshoot. And they didn't want the attention on their new dyes and chemicals and oil-based products and even electrification and basically changing the way human beings lived. They didn't want the attention to be on toxic influences. Now, it's nothing that any of us do, either individually or collectively. It has nothing to do with the way you eat, or the way you think, or your human relations, or your conception of life, or how we organize ourselves economically. Any of that stuff. None of that is ever talked about in medical school. I mean, I went to medical school, I know. Nobody said anything about the way we eat, the way we think, about our economics, about our whether we dominate or humiliate other people or anything like that. It has nothing to do with illness. It's all just basically germs. And you are a victim. You didn't do anything. In fact, they're adamant that we never, as doctors, you know, blame or suggest that a person had anything to do with why they're sick. You're just going along, and this flu virus gets you, and, you know, that's how life is. It has nothing to do with how you eat, what you think, or even your group of people, how they were treated, or economics, or, you know, anything like that. And so it's a brilliant way of looking at people if you want them to be powerless. Because a person who's a victim is powerless. I didn't do anything. This SARS-CoV-2 virus landed in my nose, and I can't do anything about it. I can't eat differently. I can't think differently. I can't organize society different so it's just and fair, and we're not dealing with poisons and electrical fields, which we know make everything scramble. None of that has anything to do with it. Spending all our money on you know, bombing and humiliating other people, none of this has anything to do with what happens to us. It's just we're victims of the virus or our genes. We've got dealt a bad hand. So we go to the doctor, what's caused my problems? You either have a virus, you have a gene, or bad luck. Right?
When I trained in medical school residency, the understanding was that when children get sick, it's always a bacteria or virus. And as I grew in my experience, I started to realize that even in cases where kids had what we were told were bacteria and viruses, and we treated them, they kept getting sick. They kept getting sick over and over and over again. And no matter how many medicines I threw at them, they still kept getting sick. It's like, what's going on here? There are hundreds of trillions of microorganisms in their body. What could be going on? So I started to understand, due to my reading outside of Western medicine, that there are other factors that can make the body sick, like poor dietary choices, food sensitivities, food allergies, exposure to air toxins, food toxins, water toxins, environmental toxins. And so when I started to delve into this area, I found an unbelievable amount of literature that's ignored in Western medicine that helped me understand other reasons kids could be getting sick. And so if I made dietary recommendations, I watched kids get better and stop getting sick. If I got the parents to get rid of the pillow that was full of dust, kids stopped getting sinus infections. If I got parents to put an air purifier in the room, or get rid of a rug, or evaluate the home for mold, and that was cleaned up, kids stopped getting sick. But what you heard from medical doctors when kids kept getting sick, oh, it's another virus. Oh, it's another virus. Oh, it must have caught another virus. Here's another antibiotic. It must be a resistant bacterial infection. Here's another one. Here's another one. And when I started to realize that actually, the reason the body gets sick is not necessarily due to infection, but due to a level of stress that has overwhelmed the body to such an extent that toxic wastes and inflammation build up. And the body's smart. It won't die until it's ready to die. So it has to do something to get rid of the materials that are causing a stress or a chemical reaction that's hurting the cells and their function. So it became clear to me that the reason the body gets sick is actually to purge this material. Because if it stayed inside, the body would fail. And so when I started watching all the kids who kept getting medicines for their presumed infections, they went on to develop very serious chronic illnesses. Why? Because the body was trying to purge and they kept getting medicine to stop it. And nobody was addressing what kept coming into the body to cause the stress in the first place. And so that shift in my practice was miraculous, because I'd see kids stop wheezing and not have asthma. I'd see kids sleep better and not move around so much. I'd watch kids stop bedwetting. I'd watch chronic coughs go away. I'd watch ear fluid stop. I'd watch adenoids and tonsils get smaller. I'd watch skin rashes improve, all from addressing the diet and the environment and making changes. And then adding some support nutritionally to help the body do the rest. And kids got better.
If you ask most people, like I would say most, you know, 99% of lay people and vast majority of doctors, believe it or not, what makes you think there's a virus? And the answer you get is, well, there's a lot of people getting sick, so it must be a virus. And so I usually say, so you must mean that what happened in Hiroshima was a virus, because a lot of people got sick and died. And so if that's the definition, then that, no, well, no, because that was a nuclear bomb. So if it spreads from one place to another and people get sick, then that means it's a virus. So like Chernobyl was a virus, right? It spread all over Eastern Europe. The reality of the situation is those kind of observations, like, and so what you're talking about, let's say you go to a place and there was always healthy dolphins, and then somebody calls you up because you're a dolphin specialist and says, oh, there's a lot of dolphins getting sick now, something must have happened. Now, that is what's called an epidemiological observation. In other words, I was fine, and then I go to a party, and then I got sick. Or my Aunt Bessie went to somewhere, and she got sick. Or all 10 children in my child's class got sick. These are all epidemiological observations. And the role of epidemiological observations in science is to generate hypotheses which then can be tested to see what the cause is. You can never, and I mean never, decide on the cause of an illness based on an epidemiological observation. And the value of it is just to generate hypotheses. So you go to the dolphins, so what happens? It could be a microbe. Or it could be that somebody put some stuff in the water. Or it could be that the glacier came and dropped, you know, cyanide in the water. Or it could be a space alien came and put a hex on the dolphins. Or it could be, you know, any number of things. But you can't use that observation to tell you what the trouble is. You have to find that. Now, most people would think, as the first guess, like I would, if somebody said the dolphins were fine and now they're not, I would wonder whether there was like some accident or some oil spill and somebody put some stuff in the water that didn't used to be there. Because the reality is, pretty much every time something like that happens, that's what happened. And then if you want, you could do an experiment, and I wouldn't suggest this, but you can put a bunch of dolphins in a cage and put the same kind of oil spill in there, toxins, and see if they get the same illness. And if they do, that's pretty good evidence that that was the problem. This business that proves it's a virus is just incredibly sloppy thinking. Like, that's not science.
was part three of the viral delusion. And I decided to go ahead and play that because I didn't have anybody holding on the line, nobody raising their hand to talk and yap. And so I went ahead and played that. And I will update the link for the show or the episode information and details to include the link for part three. I'll edit it after we wrap things up here. And that way we can have that available, easy access to it. And of course you can find this whole five-part series on Rumble called The Viral Delusion. And you can find it as well. There's a few different people that have posted this same documentary, The Viral Delusion, The Deadly Deception. I chose to subscribe to Jose Ortega, The World We Live In, and subscribe. That one was kind of the easiest one to find all of these parts to this documentary. So very interesting stuff. And I was hoping they got into smallpox. And during some of the musical pauses, they were going to some articles or research papers, describing it and showing some graphs and things like that on down the line. And that's something that I've already noticed too. Like one of the graphics that they showed was how pretty much just about every kind of outbreak attributed to a virus started, people started to get better from it. The cases were naturally going down by the time the vaccine was even made and distributed. So more cases than not, the vaccines don't really do what you're led to believe that they do. And COVID really is no different. 70% of the people or so in the United States have gotten their COVID shots, and people still get sick with it, and they want to blame it on all these variants. But if it was really effective, it would be effective against these variants. Even talking about the flu shot. Well, people get all these flu shots. They supposedly make them by trying to anticipate the mutations that'll have what's going to be the most prevalent or dominant, flu viruses around. And of course, they're never right. I mean, most people I know that get flu shots still end up getting sick with the flu at some point, right? I mean, it never seems to really work against what they say it's going to work toward. And as a matter of fact, it perpetuates more the possibility that there's other mutations going on. Is it really a virus? Might not be. And they really get into how diet and your environment contribute to disease. And like that one doctor that was saying, I was putting people on, a specific diet or a more healthy diet, even taking out an old rug. Wash your pillows. If you don't wash them, you need to buy new pillows every so often if you don't wash them. Of course, if you have down pillows, those aren't very washable. But most pillows out there aren't like that. The pillows I have, they can be washed. And I double up on the pillowcases on my pillows as well. So I have two layers of the pillowcases. And that'll keep my pillows cleaner longer, you know, my actual pillows cleaner longer by doing that. But even still, every once in a while, every few months, I will wash my pillows and make sure that they're clean, you know. I give them the sniff test, too. Certain things like that that you could be doing just by being a little more clean. And I'm not saying being like a total neat freak, because that can be harmful as well. If you're too much of a germaphobe and you're constantly sterilizing everything, then your immune system doesn't ever get a workout. You know, it can't fight off even the most normal stuff. Pretty soon, what we all normally can fight off and not get sick from, suddenly you'll get sick from it because you're exposing yourself to less and less different stuff. Your immune system's weak. And so when you do get exposed to something, your body isn't going to react to it. Or it'll overreact to it, put it that way. You'll get sick easier because your body's overreacting because it's just not used to it because you're too much of a germaphobe, you know, to actually expose yourself to anything. So there is such a thing as too much. And I think, you know, and maybe it's not so much that either. I mean, clean does not have to mean killing every single bacteria. It's just clean. You're not ingesting dirt. You're not, you know, and dust and dander and all that kind of stuff. You're not ingesting that kind of stuff, basically poisoning yourself. I'm talking about just normal soap and water. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, rubbing your hands with Purell every 5 minutes, you know, and that kind of thing. Just frequent hand washing with normal soap. This antibacterial soap is nothing but a marketing ploy, a way to sell soap, for that it does what it already, and liquid soap. I know that, you know, I did an experiment on this in college. I experimented with Dove bar soap, just plain old Dove bar soap. And then I experimented with I think it was Dial antibacterial bar soap. And then regular Dove liquid soap. And then it was Dial liquid soap and quote unquote antibacterial. And so what we did, just to make, you know, what I did is every day for 4 days, first day I go into the lab, hadn't washed my hands for a while, right? And as a control, actually it was 5 days. So as a control, the first day, all we did was just rinse our hands off with water. That's it. Day one, we walk in, we haven't washed our hands for a while, just rinse our hands off with water, and then smear our fingers on a Petri dish, put it in the incubator. Day two, come in, same soap, use the Dove bar soap. Wash our hands for 30 seconds, rinse, and then rub our fingers in a Petri dish, put it in the incubator. And then same goes for the antibacterial, quote-unquote, bar soap the following on day three. Day four, then was this the normal Dove liquid hand soap, and then day five was the quote-unquote antibacterial liquid soap. And the result of that experiment, so each one of those Petri dishes incubated for 48 hours, and we looked at the results and noted the results. Well, guess what? Both of the bar soaps and just rinsing your hand with water, there really was not much difference looking at the Petri dishes. The two bar soaps, a little less gross, you know, a little less growth happened, just a little bit though. Not an overwhelming amount. I mean, it, still plenty of crap was growing on that petri dish. But then both of the liquid soaps, the regular Dove liquid soap and the quote-unquote antibacterial liquid soap, hardly anything grew on that petri dish. And so that is telling you something. There was literally no difference between the two liquid hand soaps. The regular Dove, you know, regular Dove hand soap versus the antibacterial liquid hand soap, no difference at all between the two. Same thing, very, pretty much no difference between the different bar soaps either. And so liquid soap is naturally antibacterial. It's in the nature of it. And that experiment basically showed that, proved that. So, you know, think about that. You don't need to have this smelly, nasty smelly antibacterial quote unquote soap. And if you're using bar soap, you might want to reconsider. Bar soap is good, you know, first couple times you use it, but that's about it. I mean, after that, it's porous. Bacteria builds up in there. It's not naturally antibacterial. So a lot of the bar soaps out there, they'll clean the dirt, but don't expect it to actually kill germs, right? But I grew up using bar soap all the time, you know. And that's what I'm talking about, too, is like we don't need to be total germaphobes. All we really need to do is just wash our hands frequently, that kind of thing. Let's have a decent diet. When it comes to vitamins, throw out your over-the-counter normal vitamins, like your Centrum, your One-A-Day, that kind of thing. Those are just garbage. They're synthetic vitamins, and your body knows the difference. Get yourself whole food vitamins, whole food plant-based vitamins that have all kinds of stuff in them, and get yourself coral calcium with trace minerals, natural coral calcium with trace minerals, and your body will actually absorb that. Your body recognizes, hey, this is the real thing. This isn't synthetic. So keep that in mind, you know, and don't fall for the hype of the antibacterial in that because, you know, just get yourself liquid hand soap if you want to actually kill germs, right? Bar soap is pretty much fine for normal everyday, you know, use, but you're not going to be killing germs with it. You're just washing off dirt. And I don't really like bar soap. A lot of it doesn't rinse away very well and ends up kind of feeling like filmy. So I've been a liquid soap person for a long time. Same thing with buying more natural. I love Castile soap. It's more natural, a lot less chemicals in it. So I use that. Same thing with body washes. Try to get natural body washes where I can actually read what's in it. And because you got to realize that your skin is also, your skin is the biggest organ your body has. And yes, it does absorb things, right? Some things are permeable through the skin. And so when you are using soaps that have a lot of chemicals in them, especially in the shower, washing your hands all the time, you know, you're absorbing a lot of those chemicals and it's getting right into your body. And so be mindful of the kinds of stuff that you're using and you'll be all the healthier for it. Better your diet. Try to stay away from the GMO foods as much as possible. Now, especially with today's economy, I know that can be difficult because that's the nature of the beast. That's expensive, you know, especially in times of economic difficulty like we are seeing now, where people are struggling to afford gas, and maybe in order to afford gas, they need to commute to work every day. Maybe they're starting to go, okay, well, you know, instead of buying organic this or that, I got to cut my grocery budget a bit, and I'm going to start buying the cheap stuff. And, you know, we've all been there, right? But I noticed, you know, when I have done that, it's like my body can tell the difference. You know, when I'm normally eating organic this, organic that, organic, you know, making my own meals, stuff like that. And then suddenly I change my diet and I eat garbage food, like especially fast food. Fast food always does it. I'll just feel like, ugh, you know, just overall really ugh. And I can tell the difference. You know, my body tells me, like, hey, you're just eating garbage right now, compared to when I'm eating good, healthy, wholesome, organic foods that are absent all of the GMOs and absent the chemical pesticides and things like that. So that's my advice. And maybe that's why I hardly get sick. That and cannabis oil. Start checking into that. CBD oil. But, you know, check the source. You know, not all CBD oil is the same, right? But I'm a frequent user of, I try to get like 1-to-1-to-1 of different cannabinoids, like the CBN, the CBD. And I like to do it with the oils. And there's two studies that came out last year, I believe, one of which was here at the Oregon Health Sciences University, OHSU. And then another one that came out showing that these extracts or the oils are antibacterial, antiviral too. That they actually... The cannabis oil actually helps form like a force field or something, like a barrier, a shield around the cell membrane. And so because of that, it strengthens the cell membrane and also kind of puts a layer around it. So the cell membrane isn't as impenetrable. Isn't as effective. It's helps defend the cell, and so that is that's an immune booster as well. So you know, start looking into all these things, and I'm a believer that you know whatever is ailing us, there is something growing in this earth that will cure it. And so with that, we do have 5 minutes left and didn't have anybody call in to chit-chat and raise their hand. So probably going to wrap up this show, which is kind of a good thing anyways because I'm kind of hungry. But here's Joe. I see Joe, but you're not raising your hand yet. Joey, press 1 to raise your hand, Joey. Joey Ann. I know Joey Ann is on. Joey. Joey, Joey. Press 1 whenever you want to. 4 minutes left of the live broadcast here. And I see Joe is on the switchboard but hasn't pressed 1 to talk yet. So maybe Maybe he's eaten his sandwich. Maybe he has to pick some food out of his teeth or something. There we go. Joey!
I'm just waiting for you to get the Joey out of your system.
Joey Ann. How you doing?
How long was your clip?
I actually played two of them. The first one was the hour and 6 minutes. And nobody was on. Nobody was calling in. I gave it some time. Nobody was on the switchboard raising their hand or anything. So I'm like, well, I guess I'll go ahead and play part three. And so that one was an hour and 3 minutes. So I cranked out two of them tonight. I didn't plan on to, but I wasn't just going to sit there and talk to myself either for 2 hours. What are you up to?
Well, right now, since it's kind of late, I'll probably be getting off in a few minutes, but I thought I'd say hi.
Hello.
Now you're in a singing mood. Okay.
Hello. Well, I'm glad that somebody.
You know what? I took out your description page, and you had the link there for the video for the viral delusion. So I go to Rumble, but the problem with Rumble is that you can't fast forward when you're looking at a video, like in YouTube. So. You can. I haven't found the mechanism that does it.
Yeah, there's you could forward through. There's a progress bar right underneath the
I didn't show up on
where
my,
the video is playing
on my cell phone. I would have thought that it would,
my computer, but.
Probably
oh, by
won't.
The way,
like I say, on my cell phone.
Left of this live broadcast. So just if anybody's out there listening and you want to call in, do so right now. We got about a minute left. Live broadcast. 3998. Okay, go ahead, Joe.
So
I haven't tried it on my
phone
though.
Mute
and all that.
Yeah, I put it on. I also put it on enlargement. I left it on regular, and it didn't. I didn't see any button, any kind of line that that YouTube has that makes it visible for a person to just fast forward. So on my computer, I'll try it again, and because I found the part one. I was listening to about 5 or 6 minutes of part one, watching it. And it's interesting how even the polio vaccine wasn't done correctly, that there may actually not be a real polio vaccine. Now what happened? I'm still connected.
Yep. Let's find out, shall we? I do have my phone as a backup. So I'm still on there.
Hello.
Hello, are you there?
Yeah, you were gone for about 40 seconds or 45 seconds or so.
Weird. That's weird. My headset, because you cut out, and then it was like dead air.
Yeah.
And I was about ready to flip over to my cell phone instead.
I'll
so
bet
that's
you it's
weird.
Your headset. I remember calling into another show, and that person had trouble with her headset. Until she rearranged it, then the wires, probably the copper wires inside the cable connected together, and then everything was fixed. But it might be your headset.
Yeah, I'm thinking so. Maybe because I did get up and walk, you know, walk to the garage and start having a couple of drags of a Siggy, which normally my headset is perfectly fine. Like, I've literally, like, taken my garbage to the curb at the end of my driveway, and my headset was...
Yeah, but
fine.
You never know when wires break. So, in any case, you're in overtime now.
Yeah, we are in overtime. I'm going to try and... I'm going to unmute my cell phone because I think I do want to switch over to it because I'm thinking maybe that's it, the cell phone. So I'm going to just bear with me for a second while I disconnect from my headphone from my computer over to my cell phone. Hang on.
Are we still connected? Are we still connected?
Hang on. Still trying to get my headset connected to my cell phone, and it's giving me a hard time here. Connect. Hang on.
Okay.
My headset is deciding to be a pain in the ass here, so I'm powering it off. And then... Now let me try it again. There.
You have any spare earbuds or headsets?
Okay. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. Finally. Yeah, my phone didn't want to pair up with it for a second there. Okay, so hopefully that issue is resolved now. So I muted my Direct Connect. Actually... There.
Yeah.
Muting
my
speakers. Come on. There. Okay. Now we should be squared away. Because I don't want, like, my, you know, one of my tabs open in my browser to start playing crap. So I needed to mute my speaker and stuff, too.
Okay. Is everything everything copacetic now?
I believe so, yes. And at least, like, with my cell phone, you know, when I want to go and have a few drags of a cigarette out in the garage, I can bring my phone with me and not lose signal. But usually they said, these are my cheaper headset, my original headset that I'm using right now that I use on my Sunday shows. I use my other computer in my computer room with my better headset. And but for the Wednesday
the show, since I'm usually playing a long clip or whatever, I just use my original headsets, my cheapy ones. It still tends to work pretty good, but I made sure to charge it and stuff so that it wouldn't die on me.
So, what's the gist of part two and part three?
The gist of it is, like I said, they looked at other so-called viruses, like smallpox, like measles, that kind of thing, and they displayed a lot of articles, like original studies and things, that essentially equate to, you know, what we think has caused people to get sick, like with polio or smallpox or something, coincides with other environmental factors. So like with, I believe it was polio, it was at the same time as polio came about, was also the time that DDT was being used and lead paint. And so they were showing studies of that correlation between the use of DDT and lead poisoning, DDT being a neurotoxin and therefore explains how polio is debilitating. And so they started to go into similar things, you know, like with the measles and like smallpox, like what are, you know, instead of just explaining it all away as a virus, which has actually not been isolated, and then making a vaccine for it and all this stuff, and they produced one study where an experiment was done in two different cities with an outbreak of, I think it was smallpox, and in one city they cleaned up the water, you know, improved drinking water, improved the food, stopped, you know, not using food that's been sprayed with all this crap, and then comparing these two cities, and the city that got cleaner and had better, you know, people or had a better diet, guess what? They weren't getting sick. Or if they did get sick, they got over it. But then the city where they didn't do that, you know, then even after the advent of the vaccine, the cases, you know, it just didn't seem to make much of a difference. And so it's like, and then it showed graphs of all these different diseases attributed to viruses, showing that, you know, time after time after time, the cases were already exponentially on their way down by the time the vaccines were even being distributed.
Yeah, I heard about that. Yeah,
and so time and time and time again, it's like the vaccine that's, you know, given credit for, you know, saving everybody actually didn't really do
it. What I saw in Delusion 1, I think I saw it for about 6 minutes, maybe even less, was that the polio vaccine, they just assumed that the last experiment that they had done to try to show that there was a virus that produced polio was so scientifically unfactual that it was ridiculous. They actually took ground up tissue from a kid who had polio and inserted it into the brain of two monkeys, and both the monkeys got sick. One of them died, and they came to the conclusion that, well, yeah, the virus did it, you know. They also mentioned that Fauci, back, I think, in 1987, when he proclaimed that they actually found the virus to cause HIV. No, they didn't. This is a true viral delusion. a viral deception.
Yeah, it's earning its name. This documentary series. And that's kind of why I played part three, because I was like, okay, this is getting pretty good with part two. And then when there was nobody on the switchboard, nobody called in, I was waiting for a little bit. I'm like, okay, I'm going to give it a few minutes. But then I was like, I'm curious. I want to, continue with it. And I'm glad that I did, because parts two and three covered a lot of ground too. And so hopefully, let's see, I got to refresh my memory here. Part four, I think, is another longer one. I'm looking right now. Let's see. Was part three that we just watched? Part four is an hour. Is an hour 46 minutes. So that'll be next Wednesday.
I came in to say hi. So I said hi. So I'm gonna go and probably see you. I don't know the next time. I guess Saturday, or today's Wednesday. You don't have anything due Thursday, Friday, unless Doll comes back, which she probably won't. So then I'll probably see you on. Talk to you on Saturday, then.
Yep. So, and then again on Sunday, I don't have a guest.
Oh, you don't, huh? Okay.
Yeah, no guests on Sunday. Still without my co-host. I did text Jamana, and I didn't hear back from her. So I hope she's okay. I'll try to, I don't want to, hound her or anything, but, I texted her the other day, and I haven't heard back. I'll try texting her again maybe tomorrow and say, hey, what's going on, girl? So I hope she'll come back soon. I miss Doll. I miss my Doll Arnson, too. I know that she's super busy, but I messaged her on Facebook asking if she has an ETA and when she might be back.
Jamana's missing. Luckily, we had V on your last show, but we still need Jamada to come back. We still need Dahl to come back. So hopefully they do, so that there'll be people that'll, start their talk shows again. But in any case, babe, I'm going to wish you a good night, and probably unless, something happens, I'll talk to you on Saturday, okay? So be safe. I'll talk to you.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
You too, honey. Talk to you later.
Okay,
thanks for calling
night.
In and checking in. Good night. All righty. So with that, I'm going to wrap up the show here. Only 9:15. My time anyways, but we are into overtime, so... For those of you out there listening, I appreciate you giving a listen to the show tonight. Definitely tune in on Sunday night. It's going to be a call-in show. So hopefully the whole gang calls in and we can have some fun and talk about the latest and greatest news going on and what's transpiring out in the world. And I hope you guys all have a great rest of your week. Keep up the good fight, and I hope you all have a great evening as well. So thank you again for tuning in. This is Lucid Libertarian, and I do have a departing song that I can play. and it was Donnie that inspired it, and so I uploaded it today. And so I'm going to wrap it up with this.
Good night, sweetheart, when it's time to go home. Good night, sweetheart, when it's time to go home.
I hate to leave you, but I really must say, oh,
good night, sweetheart.
Good night, sweetheart. When it's time to go home. Good night, sweetheart. When it's time to go home. I hate to leave you. I really must say, oh, good night, sweetheart. Good night. Well, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Baby, I just can't get right. Well, I hate to leave you, baby. Don't mean maybe, because I love you so. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. I hate to leave you. I really must say, oh, good night, sweetheart. Good night, mother. Oh, and your father like it if I stay here too long. One kiss in the dark and I'll be going. You know I hate to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. I hate to leave you. I really must say, oh, good night, sweetheart. Good night.